So welcome, everyone. You can be seated. We're going to get started now. I'm going to keep my introduction very brief because I've had the pleasure of introducing Rabbi Dr. Steinberg a number of times already this week, and I know he doesn't enjoy it. The truth is, this morning he spoke at Cedars-Sinai. The introduction literally took 10 minutes because he is so incredibly accomplished. This is the person who is, without a doubt, the world expert in Jewish medical ethics. And not only has he published incredible encyclopedias, literally encyclopedias of works in Jewish law and medicine, he has been the primary consultant for the Knesset in Israel on medical halachic matters. And he's been especially, most importantly probably, extremely close with many of the most important gedolim in Israel, whether it was the Tzitz Eliezer or Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. And until this day, with many, many, including his job as the head of medical ethics at Shaare Tzedek Medical Center. And not only that, but especially when it came to the issue of brain death, when that was decided in Israel in the 1980s, he was the senior medical consultant. He's a rabbinic and medical consultant. And so he's the one who's been on the inside of all these conversations. And not only is he a rabbinic scholar, a Talmid Chacham, he happens to also be a pediatric neurologist. So it helps that he's a physician as well, and he understands these issues. And in addition to all these things, I mean, and I could say so much more, he is an incredibly kind and sweet and warm person who's just a pleasure to know. And so it's an incredible honor. Welcome to welcome Rabbi Dr. Steinberg to Knesset Israel. To all of you, thank you for being here. Welcome, Rabbi Dr. Steinberg.
Good evening. I assume you have the handouts. I'll just say very briefly that you probably all know that it's a very controversial issue whether to accept what is called brain death, although as we'll see halachically, that is not the right term, but the concept of brain death, because at the situation of diagnosing a person as brain dead, his other organs besides the brain are still viable, including the heart. And the dispute amongst the poskim is whether one can define a person as dead despite the fact that his heart is still functioning. Because in the classic way, and even nowadays, most of us probably will die in the old method, which is a cardiorespiratory death, that is that both the heart and the respiration will stop. There is a small part of people who die when they are on a respirator. And the respirator is dividing in time between the function of the brain, and especially a part in the brain stem that drives breathing, and when this is damaged, when this center in the brain is damaged, a person cannot breathe on his own and will never breathe on his own. But being on a respirator, the other organs get what they need. They get oxygen, they get all the supplies, and they continue to be viable. A life would be a wrong term if we accept that he is really dead. But it is still vital, and that is the reason that we can take out such organs and save lives of others who are in need of this transplant. So the question is, are we going by the classic definition whether the person is with a respirator or without? And that is to wait until both respiration stops and the heart stops? Or can we say that someone that we can diagnose with certainty that the brain is so damaged that he can't breathe on his own and it will never happen again, he is already defined dead by halachic criteria, as opposed to the fact that his heart is still functioning? That's the dispute amongst the great poskim of our generation. Personally, for whatever it's worth, I feel very confident and clear that what we call brain death medically, which is actually respiratory brain death, and respiratory is the important part, another brain, that is the halachic definition of a person being dead, despite the fact that his heart is still functioning. And what I want to do this evening is not to resolve the dispute and bring on each source and reference all the opinions, pro and cons, but just to learn inside the text that everyone is using, all the poskim are using, in order to formulate the opinion, what is the moment of death, and then everyone will be able to judge for himself what the sources are telling us. So let's start with a paragraph number one, which is a quote from Yuma Daf Pehei Amud Aleph. And everyone who deals with the issue of defining the moment of death is studying this paragraph from the Gemara, because that is the most clear source to discuss this issue. Obviously, in the days of Chazal, there weren't respirators, and supposedly there was no difference in time between respiration and heart function. Yet, Chazal found a situation which is unusual, but for our purposes is exactly pointing to the situation we are now in modern days. So the Gemara talks about a situation where a house collapsed on Shabbos, and there are people under the debris, and we don't know if they are alive or dead. The halacha is that pikuach nefesh doche Shabbat, and therefore we should desecrate Shabbat, do whatever is needed to remove the debris, get to the person who is under the debris, and if we find him alive, we'll continue to desecrate Shabbat in order to save his life. And if we find him that he is dead, we'll stop right there, because pikuach nefesh is only of someone who is alive. If we found him dead, then there's no pikuach nefesh anymore, and therefore we're not allowed to desecrate Shabbat. So the issue is, we remove the debris, and that's where we are standing now in this paragraph of the Gemara. We remove the debris, we find a person. Now we have to determine if he is alive or dead, because that will depend if we'll continue to desecrate Shabbat or not. So says the Gemara, Tanu Rabbonon Ad Heichanu Bodek, what is he examining, what is he checking to know if he is still alive and will continue to desecrate Shabbat, or he is already dead and we're not allowed to desecrate Shabbat. So one man de Omer says, Ad Chotmo, Ve'yesh Omrim Ad Libo. So there's one opinion that says that when we remove the debris, we get to the nostril. And obviously, the meaning of it is not to see whether he has a nose, right? This is not a sign if he is alive or dead. What do we look when we find the nose? We look if he's breathing through the nose, if there is respiration. And if we find respiration, he's alive, and we continue to desecrate Shabbos. If we don't find respiration, he is regarded dead, no matter what happens with any of the other organs, and we are not allowed to desecrate Shabbat further. And others say that you have to look not only for the nostrils, but also for the heart, and see if the heart is pumping. Now, as it looks, it is the same machlokes of nowadays. You have a person that is not breathing, but his heart is functioning. If we say at chotmo, all that we are interested is it's to know if he is breathing, and if we know that he's not breathing, the breathing of the machine is obviously not his autonomous breathing, then it's sufficient, and we declare him dead. Ad libo means that you have to see if there is a heartbeat, and therefore he's still alive. As we will see in a moment, that is not the real understanding in those days. But even if we read it this way as we understand, that is a dispute between two Tanaim, what is the important part to define someone alive or dead? Is it respiration or is it heartbeat? The Gemara, let's skip to the end of the second row. Neima hanetanai ki hanetanai. The Gemara wants to equate those two tanoim that argue whether ad chotmo or ad libo to other two tanoim that have a different dispute. And what is it? The Tanya, meichan avlad nutzar merosho. Abba Shaul omer mitiburo. Another dispute, which is more of a philosophical dispute, not related directly to any aloche. What is the starting point of the fetus? How does a fetus start? Where does he start? So one opinion is that he starts from the head and grows all the way down. And another opinion is that he starts from the navel and he grows in both directions until he becomes a human being. So the Gemara wanted to say that the one that on Shabbos, on the collapsed building, says that you look at Chotmo, would say that the fetus is created from his head, and the one that says Ad Libo would say that the fetus is created from his navel. You can already detect that it's difficult even to equate. The heart is one thing, and the navel is another thing. How can you equate the two? So we'll see in a minute what it means. But the bottom conclusion of this sugya is, and let's skip to the three last line, Ava l'inyan pikuach nefesh afilu Abba Shaul mode deikar chiyuta be'apehu dechtiv kol asher nishmat ruach hayim be'apav. So the Gemara says, no, we can't equate the two, and we can't say that the Tana Kama is like this one and Abba Shaul is like the other one, because everyone agrees, including Abba Shaul, that the essence of life is breathing. And it's a posuk in the story of the Mabul that says, Kol asher nishmat ruach hayim ba'apav. Whoever had a breathing died. So it means that if you breathe, you are alive. If you don't breathe, you are dead. And that is the conclusion. So all depends on breathing. So we see here that not only is the resolution of the dispute of the Tanoim, whether the heart or the breathing is what is important, but it is unanimously acceptable that it all depends on breathing, because there's a posuk that says it. And who can refute a posuk? Even the Tanoim can't refute it. So we need to understand what ad libo means in order to verify that we understand the Gemara. But even before understanding what ad libo means, the conclusion clearly is that breathing is the only sign. And that comes from the posuk. By the way, this posuk, Kol asher nishmat ruach chayim ba'apav, that is said in the Mabul, relates to the end of life, that whoever stopped breathing was regarded dead. But we can bring another posuk that relates to the beginning of life. How was Adam HaRishon created? It says, Vayipach ba'apav nishmat chayim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu blew in him a respiration power, and that is how he became a living creature. So the beginning is breathing, and the end is no breathing. So we can see it from both ends of life. Now, the problem is that if we want to equate Abba Shaul to the beginning of our Gemara, it doesn't work well, because Abba Shaul talks about tabur, about the navel, and the other man, the Omer, in our sugya, talks about the heart. So as you may know, the Shas that we are using is called Shas Vilna, right? Why is it called Shas Vilna? Because in Vilna, there was a widow by the name of Rehem and her sons. They found a manuscript, a handwritten manuscript of the Talmud, and they were the first to print it. So now we have a printed version of the Talmud based on the manuscript that they found. It turns out nowadays that there are at least 6 different manuscripts of the Talmud, and the one that they found is not the best of them. There are 2 or 3 others that are even more accurate, and many more Rishonim bring it according to the version in the other manuscripts rather than the manuscript that served to print Shas Bavli, Shas Vilna. So in number 2, you can see that there are differences between the different manuscripts of the Talmud. So for instance, the Venetia Dfus and the Oxford one indeed has the same version, Ad Chotmo V'yesh Omrim Ad Libo, but the London and especially the Munich one says Ad Chotmo V'yesh Omrim Ad Taburo. Even in the initial sentence of the Gemara, already it is not said Ad Chotmo and another one says Ad Libo, but it says Ad Chotmo and another one says Ad Taburo, to the navel. Now you may ask, how do you check for life on the navel? What do you see on the navel that the person is alive? You can say breathing is a sign of life. Heartbeat is a sign of life. What do you check on the navel? So we'll come to it in a minute. But the more accurate manuscripts really don't even mention the heart. No matter what we understand what the heart is doing, it's not even mentioned anywhere. It's mentioned either chotem, the nose, or tabur, the navel. And as we saw, that everyone agrees, according to the psukim, that ad chotmo is the ruling. Now, all the Rishonim, except for Rashi and the Meiri, have in their interpretation of this Gemara and Yuma, Ad Chotmo or Ad Taburo. They don't have the heart at all mentioned, most Rishonim, except, as I said, Rashi and the Meiri, that they had the version Ad Chotmo or Ad Libo. Now, if we say Ad Chotmo, let's see how Rashi understands the whole thing in paragraph number 3. Im dome lemet sheino meziz evarav ad echanu mefakeach ladat haemet. In other words, a person has to appear dead before we are testing him if indeed he is dead. We are not testing someone who appears to be alive and has some problems in either breathing or in his heart function. That will not be a sign of life and death. The sign of life and death would be only if the person appears to us that he is already dead. Ad Chotmo, we said this is the first one that says that you check the nostril, says Rashi, v'im en chiyut b'chotmo she'ino motzi ruach, vaday met v'yanichu. If he is not breathing, that is 100% indication that he is dead, and on Shabbos, we need to leave him as he is, because we are not allowed to desecrate Shabbos for the dead. So it's not even a doubtful situation. Maybe if we'll check further the heart, and we'll find that the heart is functioning, maybe he's still alive. Rashi says, no, if we go according to breathing, you check for breathing. If there's no breathing, he's 100% dead. Now, as I said, the older Rishonim have the version Ad Chotmo, Ad Taburo, and the Yerushalmi that has the same sugya as we just now saw in the Bavli Yuma, the Yerushalmi in Yuma, also has the version Ad Chotmo or Ad Taburo, and he doesn't mention the heart at all. And the Yerushalmi sometimes is a more accurate version because it was composed earlier. Now the question is, if we say Taburo, what do we mean by this? The answer is that breathing is coming from the lungs, but the lungs can't expand or retract unless the muscles around it do this action. right? If you put a lung on the table, it won't breathe. Why won't it breathe? Although it's intact and it's healthy, because you need the muscles to contract it and expand it. So there are two types of muscles that do the job. One is the intercostal muscles that when we breathe, it goes up and down and it pulls the lungs back and forth, and that's how air comes and goes. And there is the diaphragm that pushes the lungs up and down. And that is another part of the mechanism of breathing. The diaphragmatic breathing can be visible on the navel. You can see that the navel is going up and down, and that's a sign of breathing. So actually, whether we say at chotmo or at taburo, there are two signs of breathing. They are pointing to the same issue. The issue is breathing. The question, the dispute between the two is, where do you see better if the person is still breathing? Do you see it better through the nostril, or you see it better through the navel? Why is it so? Because we said that there is a posuk that says that all depends on breathing. So no one of the Tanoim can't find another mechanism that is independent on breathing and say this is a sign of life or death, because that's against the posuk. So the dispute is a technical one. We all agree that all depends on respiration. When we get to a person that we want to know if he's still breathing or not, which means he's still alive or not, there are two technologies how to detect it, either through the nostril or through the navel. And as we will see in a minute, and I'll bring it already here so it will be better explained, if you look on the third page, number 15, there was a famous question asked at the time of the Chacham Tzvi, who was the chief rabbi of Amsterdam at the time. And a female servant came to the Chacham Tzvi and to the Beis Din and said, I opened the chicken in order to clean it up, and I went to speak with my friends, with my neighbors. When I came back and I started cleaning the chicken, I didn't find a heart. And the question is the chicken treifa because it's missing a heart? So the Beis Din said, yes, it's treifa, because one of the listed organs that if they are defective, the animal or the chicken is treifa, is the heart. Came the Chacham Tzvi and said, you are saying something which is impossible. It's impossible for a chicken to be a grown chicken and living without a heart. No one can live without a heart. A heart is an essential part of life. And if the chicken wouldn't have a heart, she wouldn't stay alive. You wouldn't see the chicken in this stage. So probably, he said, what happened is when she went out to talk, a cat came in and took away the heart. And that's why she didn't find it. But that's the anecdotal story. But the Chacham Tzvi goes into great labor, as you see here, almost a whole page, to prove that you can't live without a heart. That's why he told that the Beis Din was mistaken to say that the chicken is treified. It's impossible. But why can't a living creature, whether it's a human being or a chicken, not live without a heart? Says the Chacham Tzvi, because the heart is the seat of breathing. The heart brings in and out air. And since we know that breathing is a sign of life and death, if the organ of breathing is missing, it can't live. So that goes with the understanding in ancient times. They didn't know about Harvey wasn't yet alive, and they didn't know about the circulation of blood, that really the heart has nothing to do with air and breathing. On the contrary, if air comes into the heart, it will kill the person. The heart is the organ that pushes and pumps blood. They didn't understand it that way. They thought that the heart is pushing and bringing air, breathing. So what do the lungs do? If the heart is doing this, we know today that air is coming in and out by the lungs and blood is coming in and out by the heart. But if they understood that the heart is the organ that pushes air, what do we need the lungs for? So they understood that the lungs are sort of a radiator, like in a car. You have a machine that works hard, becomes very hot, overheated. In order to cool it, there is a radiator that cools off the machine. So their understanding was that the muscle of the heart works very hard to push air, and in order to cool it off, the lungs are putting some air over the heart muscle so that the heart could continue to breathe. So we see that their understanding up to the days of the Chacham Tzvi, who lived in the 17th or maybe even 18th century, that was the understanding of the mechanism. So if we come back to our Vilna Shas version, that indeed one said ad chotmo and one said ad libo, it is one and the same, the mechanism of breathing, because the heart was the organ of breathing. So again, the question was, technically, where do you see the breathing better? Do you see it better through the nostrils or through the pumping of the heart, which is not pumping blood, but pumping air? And therefore, no one is going against the Pasuk. The Pasuk says that all depends on breathing. So from all these sources, we see that breathing is the one and only sign of life. If there is breathing, there is life. If there is no breathing, there is no life. No matter if you check the fact by the nostrils, by the navel, or by the heart. All say actually the same. Very difficult to understand it differently, because then it will go against the Pasuk. So now, how do we rule practically? There is a machloikes. There is actually a triple machloikes on how do you check if the person is still breathing, right? One says by the nostril, one version is by the heart, and one version is by the navel. So how do we rule? So if you will look, let's say, number 9, which is how the Rambam ruled on this issue. And he says, Mishenafla alav mapolet, as we said, there is a collapsed house. Safek usham, safek eno sham. We are not sure even if there is a person there, but maybe there is a person. We should, mefakhim alav, we should remove the debris, because a safek pikuach nefesh is also doche Shabbat. מצאוהו חי, אף על פי שנתרוצץ ואי אפשר שיברי, מפקחים עליו ומוצאים אותו לחיי אותה שעה. בדקו עד חותמו ולא מצאו בו נשמה, I'll come to it in a minute, מניחים אותו שם שכבר מת. So the Rambam rules that you look for the nostril, if there is air coming out, he is regarded alive and you continue to desecrate Shabbat. If you don't find air coming out of the nostrils, you're not allowed to desecrate Shabbat because he is dead. Now, etymologically in Hebrew, neshama and neshima are the same source. And it's not incidental. It's purposefully. Because if we say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu installed air into Adam HaRishon and he became alive, what did he instill in him actually? A neshama. He did it through a neshima. And therefore, etymologically, they are the same. And we find in many Rishonim that they exchange the terms between neshama and neshima interchangeably, because it's one and the same concept. And the same goes through in number 12 in the Shulchan Aruch, says the same thing, that what we go about is only whether he is breathing or not. We are not relating to any other sign of life and death. That is the only sign that we rely on. So these are the sources from the Gemara and the Rishonim. Now let's move to number 16. Number 16 is a tshuva by the Chasam Sofer. And in order to understand this tshuva, two generations before him, there was a very interesting debate between leading rabbis regarding the law of the land that was created in those days. We are talking about the 18th century, where by custom, the whole world, not only the Jews, declared a person alive or dead based on cardiorespiratory deaths, so that if a physician said there is no breathing and there is no heart beating, the person is dead. But imagine a physician in the 18th century that had no tools. He didn't have an EKG, he didn't have even a stethoscope. All he did was look with his eyes and detect with his ears what's happening, right? So he comes to a person who is lying motionless and seems to be dead, and in order to verify that he is dead, he takes a feather and puts it next to the nostrils, and if there would be movement of air from the nostrils, the feathers will move. Now, he is already an elderly gentleman. His eyesight is a little bit lower than usual. There was a little bit movement of the feather, but he didn't see. So he checks, no breathing, right? Because he didn't see that the feather is moving. His hearing was already also becoming a little less sharp than it was. He puts the ear on the chest. There was a feeble heartbeat, but he didn't hear it. So for him, there is no heartbeat. So he checks, no heartbeat. Combine the two, he writes a death certificate. And this person goes to be buried. And there were more than once occasions that the person woke up in the grave and he started screaming. He wants to get out because he just fainted. He was still breathing. There was still a heartbeat, but they didn't see. There were many mistakes. So the rule of the land became that if a physician says that the patient is dead because there's no respiration, no heartbeat, we are not going to bury him until the next 3 days, provided that he doesn't wake up in those 3 days. And after 3 days, there are already signs of death, and the person becomes rigid. And if he doesn't wake up, then we can bury him. Sounds like a good idea. We don't want to make mistakes to bury live people. But the problem from a halachic point of view is that we are not allowed to postpone the burial overnight. That's called baltalin. You're not allowed to have the person go overnight without being buried. Nowadays, in most places, we do wait a day or so until we can gather people for the Leviathan and so on. But for instance, in Jerusalem, people are buried before the night is over, sometimes in the middle of the night or even very early in the morning before the night is over, because we don't want a dead person staying overnight. That is a baltalin. So there was a dispute amongst the then rabbonim if to accept the rule of the land and not to bury the Jews the same way as the ruler said not to bury anyone until 3 days pass, or to violate this rule because it's a biblical prohibition and we Jews will bury the person and hopefully there won't be mistakes. That was the debate. So interestingly, the one who was pro the government was Moses Mendelssohn, that with time became the Haskalah leader. At that time, apparently, he was still one of us, quote-unquote, and he was a big Talmid Chochem. It's not like today's Maskilim who don't know anything and they fight whatever they can without even understanding. So he wrote an anonymous article in the then journal of the time, Bikurei Ha'itim, supporting with a lot of sources that indeed a Jew shouldn't be buried until 3 days go over, and that is okay, and there's no issue of Baltalin, no prohibition of Baltalin. the Yavetz, which was the son of the Chacham Tzvi, went against him very strongly and revealed that he is the one that wrote this article in favor of the ruler, and he came to the conclusion that we cannot violate a biblical law, even if the ruler has made such a law, and we should bury the Jews on time. Two generations later, at the time of the Chatam Sofer, and this responsa that we are seeing here, number 16, was one of the last responsa of the Chatam Sofer. After that, shortly, he passed away. And he was asked if we should continue the way we are doing now, we Jews are doing now, or go back. And what happened? That over these generations, the Jews accepted practically the ruler's law. And they kept the dead for 3 days, like Mendelssohn said, that it's okay. And that was in opposition to Yavetz. And two generations later, everyone knew who Mendelssohn is. And it was strange that we should follow Mendelssohn and not the Yavetz. So they asked the Chassam Sofer, what do we do? So the Chassam Sofer writes in brief the history that I just told you. We won't go the language that he uses, but that is in brief what happened. And why did this one say so and this one said so? So says the Chassam Sofer, and look at the bold letters, V'nech ze'ana, you ask me a question. The Jews are doing like Mendelssohn, the Yavetz said not to do so. I want to investigate and to look into it in order to give you an answer. And the surprising thing in this tshuva is that to the day of almost the last days of the Chatam Sofer, no one from Shas, Rishonim and Achronim defined the moment of death. People are dying all the time, and you won't find anywhere in Shas or in Rambam or in Shulchan Aruch a person who is in such and such situation is defined dead. There's no such ruling. It was by custom that people knew what to do, but says the Chatam Sofer, to my days, no one really set the rules. How do you define the moment of death? And that is very pertinent to our days. How do we define today a moment of death when there are changes in technology? So says the Chatam Sofer that probably over the years people knew how to do it and they didn't need a formal statement when a person is dead or not. But in later generations, including my generation, says the Chatam Sofer, we forgot how to actually determine the moment of death, and therefore there is now a dispute between the Chachamim. So he brings the Gemara Yuma, which I told you is the source that everyone discussing the moment of death relates to it. And if you'll see at the end of the bold paragraph, he brings the posuk Kol Asher Ruach Chayim Be'apo, the Hakol Talui B'Neshimat Ha'af, U'Kemevu'ar B'Yuma Pehei Amud Alef, U'Pasku Rambam V'Tur Shulchan Aruch. So says the Chatam Sofer in conclusion, based on the Gemara Yuma, based on the Psak of the Rambam, based on the Psak of the Tur in Shulchan Aruch, everything depends on breathing through the nostril. Not the heart and not the navel and not any other function, breathing through the nostril. So if you'll check for breathing through the nostrils, if there is breathing, he is alive. If there is no breathing, he is dead. And that's all. There's nothing else that we need to know. And therefore, if a physician checks a person in the days of the Chatam Sofer or earlier and says that there is no breathing, he should be buried, because this is the definition of death, and we don't have to wait for 3 days. That is his conclusion. Later on, in the paragraph after the bold one, and again, I won't read all of it, he brings an interesting source from the Moreh Nevuchim. Moreh Nevuchim was written by the Rambam as a philosophical discourse. It's not a halachic book, it's a philosophical discourse. And the Rambam discusses the stories about Ben HaTzofatit and Ben HaShunami. There were two instances with Eliyahu and Elisha that a child seemed to be dead, and they revived the child. And the question is, were they really dead, and it was a miracle that the prophet was able to revive them, or they just fainted, and by doing mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, as the Posuk is describing, the child woke up. So the Rambam distinguishes between the two stories. In one case, he said it was really dead, and it was a miracle that he woke up. And in the other one, he just fainted, and he woke up. And it says there that the choli was a choli lev kashe, that the heart didn't do the job appropriately. And that's why they needed the intervention of the prophet. So based on all this, and now we'll see the bold letters at the end of the responsa. Aval, kol she'acher she'mutal ke'even domem, ve'en bo shum tfika, ve'im achar kach batel ha'neshima, en lanu ela devrei toratenu ha'kdusha she'hu met, ולא ילינו אותו, והמתמה לו אם הוא כהן, לוקח הרת רמה. So the conclusion of the Chassam Sofer is the following. Anyone that is lying like a stone, which means he is motionless, and in our terminology in modern medicine, we would say he is in deep coma. His Glasgow coma scale is 3. He doesn't respond to anything. So he calls it mutal ke'even domem, like a stone, doesn't react, doesn't respond, doesn't move. If this is one condition, ve'ein bo shum tfika, and you can't detect any heartbeat, im achar kach batel ha'neshima, if you have these two signs already in place, and now you are checking for breathing, and there is no breathing, he is dead, and you're not allowed to postpone the burial, and so on. So it seems a contradiction within the responsum of the Chatam Sofer between the beginning and the end. At the beginning it says, Hakol talui b'neshimat ha'af. There are no other signs. And all of a sudden, because of the Moreh Nevuchim, which is never a source for halacha, you never learn halachas from Moreh Nevuchim, but based on the story in the Moreh Nevuchim, he added two other signs to say that a person is dead. But it is very clear to me and to those who accept brain death that these are prerequisites, but they are not signs of death. In other words, a person is dead if he is not breathing. That is clear from all the previous sources. But how do we know that it is irreversible? Maybe a doctor came in to a patient, put the feather, and there was no breathing. But maybe in half an hour, or in 10 minutes, or in half a minute, there will again be breathing. How do you know that it's irreversible? And obviously, if it is reversible, then the person is not dead. Otherwise, it would be tchiyat ha-meitim, right? And we don't know how to do it. Even the best doctors don't know how to do tchiyat ha-meitim, at least to this point. So, how do we know it's irreversible? Says the Chassam Sofer, based on the Moreh Nevuchim as a factual matter, not as a halachic matter, as a factual matter. If the person is not moving, and if there is no heartbeat, then if he stops breathing, we know two things. One is that he is dead, not because he doesn't have a heartbeat or he's not moving, but because he's not breathing. But we know also that he will never breathe again because we saw that he is not moving and there's no heartbeat. So these are prerequisites but not parts of the definition. Why is it important? Because obviously in the Chasam Sofer days, there weren't respirator yet. It was invented only 70, 80 years ago, not 200 years ago. So in a case of a respirator where there is no breathing but there is continuing heartbeat, if we will go by the science of the Chasam Sofer, we still can't declare that he's dead. But why does a Chasam Sofer need the heartbeat? Just to verify that it's irreversible. Nowadays, we can prove it's irreversible by the death of the brain. And if the brainstem is dead and the respiratory center is not functioning, this person will never breathe again. So the signs of the Chasam Sofer are exchangeable as long as we are talking only on the prerequisites. The breathing is not exchangeable. Breathing was and is and will be the sign of life and death, and this didn't change. Not from the Chasam Sofer, not from the Chacham Tzvi, and not from the Gemara. So that is how we can understand the progress of the issues. Now, that was then. Now we come to our era. And in our era, as I said, there is a respirator, and there is a separation in time between the cessation of breathing and the function of the heart. Is the person in the interim still alive because the heart is beating, or is he dead because he's not breathing irreversibly based on the brain rather than based on the heart? And that, as I said, is disputable. The first one that entered into it in a very serious matter was Moshe Feinstein. And his first, he wrote four tshuvas on this matter, whether brain death, respiratory brain death, is halachically acceptable or not. He wrote four different tshuvas, seemingly contradicting each other. But understanding the circumstances when he wrote the different tshuvas, there's no contradiction at all. Obviously, he was smart enough to say what he thought and not contradict himself within a short period of time. So the first responsum was written in 1970, 2 years or 2.5 years after the first heart transplant that was done by Christian Barnard in Cape Town. And what people told him as a fact was that what Christian Barnard did the transplant at the end of 67, December 67 was the first heart transplant, and January 68 was the second heart transplant. The first medical criteria of brain death, which are called the Harvard criteria, were published at the end of 68, almost a year after the two first heart transplants, which means that Christian Barnard did not have established criteria to diagnose brain death. He did it on his own. Whatever he thought was right, he made up his mind that this is a dead person and he can take out the heart and transplant it to whoever was in need. By the way, a Jew was the first to receive the first heart transplant, and he lived only 18 days after the transplant. There was a mistaken conception by Christian Barnard. He didn't understand the rejection issue there, and this heart was rejected, and the patient died after 18 days. So this was presented to Moshe Feinstein in the following way. They told him that the donor was a young lady that was in a car accident, and she sustained a severe head trauma. And the neurosurgeons in the hospital where Christian Barnard did the transplant told him that such a brain injury can't survive. That is irreversible, and for them, she's dead. She was intubated, and what was related to Moshe Feinstein was that he took out her heart based on their definition that she was brain dead, while she was still breathing, because they supposedly didn't know that this is part of the criteria to say that a person is brain dead. So writes Moshe Feinstein, look at number 17. מה שאומרים הרופאים שסימני חיות ומיטה הוא בהמוח, שאם לפי השערותיהם אין המוח פועל פעולתו, הוא כבר נחשב למת, אף שעדיין הוא נושם, says in the next paragraph, האמת ודאי שלא זה שפסק המוח לפעול הוא מיטה, דכל זמן שהוא נושם, הוא חי. So in other words, says the Moshe, they thought that the definition of death is brain death. If the brain is dead, the person is defined dead. Says Rav Moshe, we don't find any source. We just now learned all the sources in Shas related to the definition of death. The brain isn't mentioned at all. The brain is irrelevant to the definition. What is relevant to the definition? If he's breathing or not. And if it is true what they told me, that the heart was taken out from this donor while she was still breathing, they actually killed her. She was alive and they took out her heart. And he concludes that what happened there was a double murder. They killed the donor because she was still breathing and they took out her heart. And they killed the recipient because he could have lived longer with his heart disease. And because of the transplant, he died earlier, only 18 days. And therefore, it's a murder of him. So it's a double murder. That is the first response. So some people take it verbatim and say that any situation that you take out a beating heart is an act of murder, and therefore you're not allowed to do. But it can't be written more clear that it all was based on the fact that he assumed that she was breathing. Now, I'll tell you an anecdote. This hospital in Cape Town is an old building, and it stopped to be a hospital. And the authorities there decided to turn it into a museum. If you ever visit Cape Town, I suggest you go to this hospital. And they show minute by minute how the heart transplant occurred. So they have wax figures. Here was Christian Bernard, here was his assistant, here was the recipient, here was the donor, and so on. And it's very interesting to see with a timetable. At 1 a.m. she arrived, at 2 a.m. they said so, at 3 a.m. they said so, and they showed the whole process. When I visited the place, I won't go into all the reasons, but at that time, a few years ago, there were only three people still alive that were part of the transplant team, of the first transplant. One of them was a nurse, a respiratory technician, and she was willing to give me a tour herself to explain to me what happened. I obviously didn't tell her what I'm interested to know because I wanted it to come from her spontaneously. And she took I was with my wife, and she took us around, and she told us, you see this box, that's me. Here I was standing when it happened. So it was a real witness. And she said that what happened was the following. This lady came in with a severe head trauma from the car accident. She was intubated. And when the neurosurgeons told Christian Bernard, no chances that she can survive, he took her down with the respirator to the operating room, and in the next operating room was already the recipient being prepared to receive the heart. And at the operating room, he disconnected the respirator from the girl and waited for the heart to stop for 5 minutes and then opened the chest, revived the heart, and took the heart for transplant. So I asked her, people say that she was still breathing at the time. She said, how could they say? I saw the victim, the donor, without a respirator, with a severe brain injury, not only not breathing, but her heart even stopped. So she was totally dead. I think that if Moshe Feinstein would have known this fact, he would say that it's even worse than what he thought. Because actually what they did, they killed her. They removed the respirator while she was still alive, and that killed her. So they did an act of murder even before they took out the heart. So that obviously wouldn't help the discussion. But that is a less important part to understand the position of Feinstein, because what he stressed was that if a person is still breathing, he is alive. If you can prove that the person is not breathing and it's irreversible, then the heart is irrelevant. That's what comes out from his response. Now, we'll skip the other two responses related to Brandeis of Moshe Feinstein, and we'll go to number 19, which was written about half a year before Moshe Feinstein passed away. And at that time, he was asked again, how does he define the moment of death? And he said that what the physicians call Harvard criteria is acceptable halachically, even though the heart is still functioning. He stresses to say that the heart is irrelevant to the definition of death in a case that the person is not breathing, and according to the Harvard criteria, he will never breathe again. And that he says very clearly. I put in bold the last two lines of this responsum. Hine af shalev adayin yachol litchof lekama yamim, even though the heart is still functioning even for the next few days. Mikol makom, kol zman she'en la'chole koach neshima atzmait, as long as the patient can't breathe on his own, he is breathing, but artificially by the machine. That is irrelevant. If he's not breathing on his own, ukedibarti b'tshuvati, and so on, this is the sign that he is dead, and he is dead by what the Harvard criteria call brainstem or whole brain criteria, but halachically, it's respiratory brainstem, because the sign of life and death is respiration, and the brain is only to support the understanding that it's irreversible, not as a sign on its own. And that is very clearly stated by Rav Feinstein, and it's very difficult to explain him differently in order to fit him to the position that doesn't accept brain death. But it seems very clear. I want to skip the position of Auerbach, which is quite complicated. And what happened in Israel was that in 1986, the hospital Hadassah in Israel was ready for the first heart transplant. But in order to perform a heart transplant, you need to accept brain death. And the authorities turned to the chief rabbis then, Rav Shapira and Rav Eliyahu, and posed the question, is halachically a brain dead person who can't breathe on his own dead? And then if you say yes, we will be able to take a heart and save someone who is in need of the heart. I was privileged to be the medical advisor to the chief rabbinate at the time, and we had lengthy discussions on what the meanings of all these new concepts are. And the final ruling of the chief rabbinate in 1987 was that the principle of respiratory brain death is the halachic definition of death. Based on that, one can take out a heart that is still beating and transplant it. However, the chief rabbis were hesitant to trust physicians. And without insulting whoever is a physician here, their fear was that it's something very new. Not many physicians are familiar with the whole process, that no one is studying it in medical school and certainly not then to know how to do it. And they may cut short some corners because they think that they are doing something good. They are going to save a life by taking out the heart. Anyway, this patient either is dead or he will die. So what's the difference? So we'll take out the heart when it's more convenient rather than wait for 2 a.m. We'll do it in 10 in the morning. It's more convenient. And we'll take the heart and we'll save a life. So they were worried that that may happen. And therefore, they decided not to rely only on the Harvard criteria, which, again, without going into the details, for whoever knows, whoever doesn't, it's not so important to know the details. But the importance is that the Harvard criteria are based on an assessment, a subjective assessment of the physician who is diagnosing brain death. He looks if the person is breathing, he looks if the pupils are responding, he looks if there's called caloric test, if there's response, and so on. And that is very subjective. He may miss some movement, or he may avoid looking at something, or whatever can happen. And therefore, they required a confirmatory objective test, which means that you do a test that proves, for instance, no blood flow to the brain, or proves no electric activity in the brainstem, and that has a printout, and everyone can look at it and say, yes, this is what happened, and it's an objective sign. The medical establishment didn't want to accept it, and I remember sitting with the two chief rabbis when the director general of the Ministry of Health came to the rabbis and said, thank you very much that you are enabling us to save lives because you accept brainless, but we absolutely disagree for you to tell us how to do it medically. We are the experts. You are not the expert on what tests to do and how to do the test. That's a medical situation. And he told the chief rabbis, imagine that I come to your shul and I'm telling you when to say avarachamim. You are the rabbi of the shul. That's your expertise. You'll decide when to say avarachamim. I can't tell you when to say. The same here. You give us the principle, but the facts are medical, and we should decide. So there was back and forth over 20 years of fighting back and forth until in 2008, a member of Knesset by the name of Schneller decided to legislate and to finish the dispute. And I helped him to formulate the legislation, which went in accordance with the chief rabbis. And in the Knesset, there was a big fight that the medical establishment came to convince the members of parliament to not accept it. We are the experts. We tell you we don't need it. But one of them said very smartly to them, he said to them, why are you opposing to what the chief rabbis are proposing? Is it because you think it's wrong, or you think that you can do without it? And obviously it wasn't wrong. It was a confirmatory test that is used as a medical device, not only for brain death, for other measures, and it's a legitimate tool. You say you don't need it. Okay, so do something that you don't need and we'll get the approval of the chief rabbis and we'll get more organs to save people. Why should you oppose it? Doesn't make any sense. So finally, the final reading was that everyone of the Knesset accepted, and currently the law of the land is according to the chief rabbinate, and all hospitals in Israel do it the same way, which, by the way, is different than diagnosing brain death, let's say, in the United States or in any other country. And that poses some problems to whoever wants to follow the brain death criteria, but I won't go into it at the moment. But before the reading, two things happened. I remember that the second and third final reading in the Knesset was supposed to be on a Wednesday. Motzai Shabbat, before it, I get a call from Moshe Gafni, who is still a member of Knesset, the head of Aguda, And he tells me that he doesn't understand the word, what the law says. He's not a physician, he's not a rabbi, he doesn't know what it says. He doesn't know not only if to vote for or against, but he wants to explain it to Rav Eliashiv, who is the leader of the Aguda from a halachic point of view, but he doesn't know how to explain to him because he doesn't understand it. Would I come with him to Rav Eliashiv and explain to him what the law is saying for him to tell Gafni if to vote for or against? So we come up to Rav Eliashiv and I explain how the achievement that the chief rabbinate for years was fighting for a more secure way of determining the moment of death, and here the law is going according to the chief rabbis, and that is, and I explained what the law is going to say. So he said, that's excellent for the chief rabbis. They accept brain death in principle, and therefore all their criteria are fulfilled. That's excellent. But I don't accept brain death as a principle. So this doesn't help me. Even if you are sure 100% that the person is brain dead, I think that as long as his heart is functioning, he's still alive. So it doesn't help all what you are doing. So supposedly, Gafni should vote against, because if you ask me, I am opposed to it. So I came on the spot with the idea to add a paragraph to the law which will say that for those who don't accept brain death in principle, not because of the details, but in principle, the person, even if he's diagnosed brain death, will remain on a respirator until the heart will stop. And then it will be good for everyone. Those who accept brain death, he will be diagnosed brain dead and either donate organs or just go to the morgue. And those that don't accept it, we won't touch the respirator and the heart will stop. Usually it takes another 24, 48 hours and then the heart will stop. So he said, if this can be achieved, he told Gafni to vote against the law, but make every effort that the law should pass. And I think his idea was that in principle, the law is against his understanding of halacha, so you can't vote for it. But practically speaking, that's the best that can be achieved, and everyone has his share in it, so why not? And then the chief rabbi of Israel, the Sephardi chief rabbi, was Rav Amar, and Shas went to him to ask how to vote, because they don't know what the halacha is. And Rav Amar, I had many discussions with him previously, and he's very much for brain death. He thinks that's the halachic definition. He had no doubts. But such a national matter, he didn't want to count on himself. He wanted Hav Avadia Yosef to decide. So on Monday, and remember, on Wednesday is going to be the final vote. On Monday, we went to Rav Avadia Yosef. Eli Yishai was then the head of Shas, and Rav Amar and myself. And I presented to Rav Avadia Yosef what the law is going to say. And he, on the spot, went over with all the sources that I told you, without knowing what we came for. I mean, really everything was clear to him. And he said, clearly, brain death is acceptable. And he told Eli Yishai to vote for the law. So comes Wednesday. So all the parties voted for, except for Gafni, who had to represent Rav Eliashiv. They invited me to be a guest of honor, so I was sitting very close to the podium where the delegate spoke. And he gets up and starts screaming, what a terrible law, you're not allowed to do it, that's a terrible... And he waves to me like this and says, like, don't worry. And then outside, he told me that he told all the members of Knesset, you can go ahead, it's okay, but I have to oppose it because Rav Eliashiv told me to oppose, and he opposed it, and that is now the law of the land. And I want to conclude with the meeting at Rav Avadia Yosef together with Rav Amar, when Rav Avad Yosef told Eli Yishai to vote for, Eli Yishai said, "I want it in writing." So Rav Avad Yosef said, "What do you need it? I'm telling you, this is the halacha, this is how you vote." So he said, "I know what will happen. I'll vote for, and then everyone will scream at me, 'You didn't hear right, Rav Avad Yosef didn't agree, you distorted it.' I don't know how to answer such issues. I want it in writing, and then whoever will come to me with complaints, I'll show him that you agreed to it." So on the spot, Rav Amar wrote the following: "בישיבתנו היום, לפני מרן הראשון לציון פוסק דורנו, הרב עובדיה יוסף, הופיעו הפרופסור My Name, ואחרי שמסר סקירה מפורטת וצמציתי בדבר הבדיקות הנעשות בימינו אלו לקביעת המוות, ואחרי ברורים שונים, מרן שליטה חיווה דעתו דעת תורה, שמעיקר הדין המוות נקבע עם מות המוח כולו, כולל גזע המוח, והפסקת הנשימה באופן בלתי הפיך. These are the criteria, this is דעת תורה, this is the הלכה. ובלבד שהכל יעשה על פי נאמנים," and he goes into the tests that have to be done, like the chief rabbinate required. And this is what Rav Amar wrote, and Rav Avad Yosef co-signed, "הדברים הלל נעשו בהסכמתי המלאה על פי דעת תורה, והכל ברור ויציב ונכון וקיים." And he signed it. So that is how the final understanding is currently in Israel, that on the one hand, many of the poskim agree with the concept of respiratory brain death, respiratory as the sign of death, and brain death as a proof that it's irreversible, provided you do all the tests according to the Harvard criteria, plus confirmatory tests and some other additions. And for those who don't accept, in principle, brain death, the person will be on a ventilator, until the heart will stop. So with this, everyone can live in peace with the situation in Israel. So that is from the perspective from the Gemara to the current poskim. Thank you.
Thank you. So we will daven Mariv now. And